connecting to the AOC Podcast Network. Enjoy your stay.
This is Jan Swift, and you're listening to Discover Lafayette, a podcast dedicated to the people, places, and culture of Lafayette, the gateway to South Louisiana and the region we know as Acadiana. We focus on the warm joie de vivre, or joy of living, exemplified by our people, the beautiful scenery, delicious food, and cultural traditions passed down generation after generation. We also highlight the many opportunities and reasons businesses decide to make their home here. Today's episode features Kimberly James Boudreau, Executive Director of Catholic Services of Acadiana. Founded in 1973 by the Roman Catholic Diocese of Lafayette, services offered include St. Joseph Diner, which serves free lunch meals, St. Joseph Emergency Shelter for Men, and complementary programs offering emergency, transitional, and permanent supporting housing for men, women, children, and veterans. On any given night, Catholic Services of Acadiana provides shelter to over 120 adults and 100 children. Catholic Services also partners with Our Lady of Lourdes Regional Medical Center to offer free health care to the uninsured, poor, and homeless through the St. Bernadette Clinic, which has since been expanded to include a free dental clinic. In 2012, Stella Maris Center, a hygiene facility, was created to offer a place for basic hygiene needs. In 2012, Catholic Services of Acadiana also began operating a rehousing program to work one-on-one with individuals experiencing homelessness. They help them secure affordable permanent housing, and they also support the clients through case management, ensuring that they have resources to maintain their home and help them get things such as income, furniture, and food needs stabilized. Kim, I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I don't know how you have time to even read the newspaper. I wanted to get in what Catholic Services offers. Mm-hmm. And I know that you also offer so much more to the community, such as disaster relief services and all. But let's first jump in about you, Kim, and talk about how you ended up as Executive Director of Catholic Services of Acadiana.
Thank you, Jan, and thank you for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
As a guest. My journey to Catholic Services of Acadiana has been a blessing, and it's been a joy to be in service to the community over the last 16 years. And it's coming to Catholic Services of Acadiana. I was previously working as a foreign missionary, serving in Mexico, India, Thailand, and Malaysia. I felt a strong calling. Mm-hmm. When I was young, to give my life in service to people experiencing poverty and people suffering. And originally, whenever I was young, I thought that my life would be spent in third world poverty, and I had a great love for, third world missions. And after September 11th, there was a lot of, in 2001, there was a lot of uncertainty in the world, and mm-hmm. I returned home temporarily, and I was discerning where my next step, my next move would be, and I felt an urging to go and volunteer locally at St. Joseph's Diner, and my life changed at that point, and I recognized the need that existed within our own community mm-hmm. and the poverty that existed right in our backyard. And, you know, Mother Teresa, who I have great admiration for and worked with her order in Calcutta, once said, "Go home and find your own Calcutta, and mm-hmm. You don't have to."
She did focus on that your neighbor is right beside you.
That's right.
Yeah. And let's back up before we get into St. Joseph's Diner, your volunteer work. Mm-hmm. You were very young when you traveled. You left the country to find your calling, mm-hmm. which brought you back. But can you talk about that? I mean, how old were you when you left to go serve internationally? Were you out of, you were right out of high school?
Or? No, I was at the end of my college years.
Okay. Where did you go to college?
I went to UL. Mm-hmm. It was USL at the time.
Yeah, the late 90s.
Late 90s and, or mid 90s, mid mm-hmm. to late 90s. And I was very young and I thought at first, whenever I felt in prayer that I was to spend my life in service, that I would do it later in life after I'd had a family and children, and after I'd finished a career, I would retire and serve and volunteer. And it was very clear, it became very clear to me through my prayer life that my calling to service was now. And so it kind of just took my plans that I had had for my life and put them aside. And
I
responded to that call. I can't imagine a life more filled with joy. And even though, you know, there's been many challenges through life of service, I can't imagine a life more filled with joy. And having the opportunity to be with people in poverty, I think that you're never so close to the heart of God than you are when you are with people that are suffering. And I've always felt the nearness of God in my life of service.
I know that people really turn to God when they don't have anything. That's when you realize the true need for God. And so you've witnessed that firsthand. And you talked some, before we started the interview, we were talking about your backstory, and you really witnessed extreme poverty in India in particular, but I'm sure in Thailand and Mexico and other countries you've traveled to.
Yes.
The people have faith. They have deep faith, don't they?
Right. And I think that when we're, you know, experiencing suffering is oftentimes when, you know, I believe God is nearest and God is most evident in our lives. And so it's been a great honor to be able to see God's presence through people in poverty and to be of service to them. And they've been just as transformative to me in my life as I in any way have been in theirs. And so it's a mutual a service, and recognizing that we all experience poverty just in different ways.
We do. Spiritual poverty.
That's
in
right.
many ways. Yeah. So that you came back and you volunteered at St. Joseph's Diner, which is a well-known diner. Many people volunteer there, donate food, donate their time and services. So what happened? You were back from
Showed up one day to volunteer, and rather than serving in the kitchen, I decided to spend my time eating lunch with those that were eating the meal that day, and spending time with them to learn more about their stories. And I think before that day, my perception of poverty in America was I felt that if you were poor in America, you were lazy, and that we had so many opportunities in America that other countries don't have. And I didn't have a lot of compassion in my heart for people experiencing poverty in America. It was almost a sense of resentment because there was so many opportunities in America, and I felt like, you know,
I did it. Why can't you?
And that day transformed my opinion about poverty in America, because as I was eating lunch at the diner, I recognized that so many people that were there were suffering from profound mental illness, and the challenges that they faced in their illness was, you know, was very real. It was palatable to me to have conversations with people. I had lunch with a man that he didn't even know where he was from. And he, when I asked him where he was from, he couldn't say where he was from. He had no recollection of where his family was. And it really changed my opinion about poverty in America, and that there were issues that existed within our community that wasn't so clear cut, that if you went and got a job or went back to school, there were barriers there. And what I came to recognize and appreciate about what Catholic Services was doing was that they were creating an opportunity for people that were experiencing poverty. They were serving as that opportunity and to help people move forward in their lives, and they were helping to transform the lives. You know, we are blessed in America to have those opportunities, but there are many barriers that people experience on that journey to improving their lives. And so Catholic Services was helping to mitigate some of those barriers and helping facilitate some of those opportunities. And so I was witnessing people going from homelessness back into stable housing and employment and achieving education. And I came to really appreciate what the work
right.
they were doing.
It wasn't just feeding them for one day. It was okay. helping them learn to survive day to day.
Right.
To get the help that they needed. I know, was it in the 80s, a lot of the mental health system, the support system was taken away.
Right.
A lot of the hospitalization and programs that were available were cut. And so that's when a lot of people that were homeless ended up with nowhere to go.
Right.
And so they do end up somewhere, and I guess a lot of them end up homeless.
Right. And it's, you know, amazing to me that we're in 2017 mm-hmm. today, and we still really haven't figured it out.
Yeah. Nothing's changed.
As a country, well, a lot of things have changed. We've tried a lot of different approaches, but we've not found a truly effective approach mm-hmm. to address comprehensively humanely address mental illness, and that there's not enough resources or access to those services that we know are needed to help achieve and maintain stability. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, that is a great challenge amongst people that are experiencing homelessness, is accessing behavioral health services and to be able to achieve stability.
Right. So you were volunteering there. I mean, I guess you mm-hmm. went back the next day. You had lunch one day and you went back.
They actually hired me the first day.
Did you need a job? It's like,
well,
okay.
I was volunteering that day, and they offered me a job that first day. And I said, well, I guess I'll do this until mm-hmm. I figure out what God really wants me to do with my life. And 16 years later, I'm still mm-hmm. I'm still with them. So it's been a great journey, because I was originally offered a very small job and in a very small office, and essentially it was a glorified volunteer job. Mm-hmm. And through the years, I worked in various positions in the organization, and in 2004, I was asked to fill the executive director position, which I later accepted in 2005. Mm-hmm. And so
Well, Kim, in the bio that I was reading in the background on Catholic Services, since you've been director, that's when a lot of the growth has happened. That's when a lot of the additional programs, such as Stella Maris Center and other programs, have been added. So do you want to talk about that, some of the growth? Like, right. this was after 9/11, and, that affected Lafayette, but like we were talking about, the homeless, the problems had been there. So were you the one that was driving some of these additional programs to come on as you right. saw the need?
So when I accepted the position of executive director in 2005, a week later, Hurricane Katrina hit.
Uh-huh. That's true. Yeah, your timing was incredible. Huh?
And so initially it was a lot of work that we did was related to disaster relief. And
were you trained in any of that?
No. So it was on-the-job training uh-huh. in disaster, and learned a lot through that experience. And
Lafayette was flooded with people from, literally, right, but I mean also from other, yeah, right. from New Orleans, and right. then after Rita, we right. had the Lake Charles.
Right. So originally,
contingent.
A lot of my work was focused on, uh-huh. or a lot of the organization's work was focused on disaster. As we moved beyond that, I looked at the organization and recognized that we were duplicating a lot of services that already existed within the community. We were operating thrift stores. We were operating food banks. We were doing a lot of things that other organizations mm-hmm. were doing and doing well. And so we just comprehensively evaluated our programs. And where there was duplication within the community, we had to ask ourselves, are there other partners within mm-hmm. the community that we can work with that we can maybe shut down our thrift stores and partner with Goodwill? And that's what we do today. We ask our donors to consider donating clothes and in-kind items to Goodwill. And in exchange, they provide us with gift cards so that our clients can shop in their stores for free. With our food distribution, we're giving out boxes of food from St. Joseph's Diner, when there were many other organizations mm-hmm. like FoodNet that were providing food boxes to the community, and they were doing it well. And so we had conversations with them to say, can we partner with you for that service? And we're going to focus the diner on preparing and serving meals for people that don't have the ability to prepare their own mm-hmm. meals. And so we started paring back on the programs and services that we were doing that was redundant and was kind of a waste of limited resources. There's so many nonprofits that exist within our community, and there's just not enough charitable dollars to support every organization doing their own thing. And so I believe in collaborations. So once we kind of pared down our essential functions, we recognized that we were really good at addressing and responding to homelessness. There were some areas within homelessness that were not being met, such as hygiene services. We recognized that there was no place in our community that people that were unsheltered could go to take a shower, go to wash their clothes, go to use the bathroom. Mm-hmm. These were basic essential functions that a person needs. And we looked at our building and we identified some office space, and I talked to our architects and asked, you know, can I put some showers in our offices and kind of like a laundromat? And so I said, yeah, you just need a large dehumidifier. And so we, you know, sought out funding for the renovation and also some operational grants through HUD to be able to open up a hygiene center, which is now Stella Morris Center. We also recognized that our shelter programs were doing a good job of sheltering people, but what were we doing to facilitate their movement into housing? Mm-hmm. And so we really began focusing on trying to have our shelters function as an emergency response to a housing crisis, much like a hospital serves as an emergency response to a health crisis. That's not a permanent destination, and you don't stay in a hospital for a long period of time, but that there's a plan to transition out. And so we've spent a lot of focus on how long people stay in our shelters. We, you know, at that in the beginning, when I first started, people would stay in our shelters for years. It was not uncommon for people to stay in our shelters for 2 years.
Oh, you didn't, like, kick them out after 90 days?
No. And so we wanted to drop that down so that no one was having to stay in shelters for long periods of time. It wasn't good for them, and it also...
And then it kept others from getting the assistance they might need.
Right. And so we invested in housing programs so that we can, and trying to transition people into housing. Uh-huh. And so at this point, we're now transitioning about 400 homeless people every year from homelessness into housing. And we're trying to get our shelter stays down to 30 days for an individual. Mm-hmm. Although right now we're about at 85 days per person is our average length of stay. So we're making progress towards that end. But we've added the programming to be able to help make that happen.
You mentioned HUD. How do you fund your programs? Is this something, is it a collaborative effort with government grants and local? How do you fund what you do?
The majority of our funding comes from government grants. We're largely funded by HUD and the VA, and it's about 65% of our revenue comes from government contracts.
Do you have to apply every year for these grants and show that you're being effective with the use of the money?
Yes. They're annual applications, and federal, state, and local applications are annual. And as we're looking at the HUD budget for this year, we're expecting that there's going to be a great reduction of homeless services. And for all the homeless programs that exist within our community, anytime that one homeless program gets affected through loss of funding, it affects the whole system.
It affects all of us.
It affects the
community.
Yes. And so we've seen a decrease in funding in the past couple of years. And when that happens, that affects the whole system of homeless providers. And so the rest of our funding comes from community support. We raise money in the community. We seek local support. And then we write grants through private foundations.
So you are separate. The Catholic Services is a separate entity from the Catholic Diocese of Lafayette. I wanted to get that in. You're not, I guess you can say you're self-supporting. You don't rely on the local churches. Is that correct? There might be fund drives if it's needed, but that's not really your source of funding at all. You're a separate charitable organization.
We're a nonprofit that operates under the auspices of the Catholic Church. And so we are a part of the diocese, but we operate independently. And so
you don't run to them if you need something. You're
right. So we
expected to be self sufficient?
Financially, yes, we operate independently, although we are operating under the auspices of the diocese, and so the bishop is the permanent chair of our board. Under our funding structure, we do ask the churches around our diocese to consider supporting our programs, and there are a number of Catholic churches within our diocese that do support us and our programs. But we're not, and I think it's a major misconception that, you know, the diocese just, you know, funds our entire operation. We work in collaboration with them, but they are not, you know, we're not entirely funded by the diocese, and that we're expected to raise the money that we need to be able to sustain our programs.
Well, tell me about St. Bernadette Clinic, and I knew that there was a Lafayette Community Healthcare Clinic, and sometimes I don't know if others do, get some of the services confused. So this is a separate clinic. You partner with Our Lady of Lourdes, is that correct?
That's right.
And where is that located? Is that downtown also?
So the St. Bernadette Clinic was established in partnership with our organization, but it's owned and operated by Our Lady of Lourdes, and it is located on our campus. They occupy part of our building, and they have a beautiful clinic that is open to free dental and free medical services. It operates kind of like a walk-in clinic for individuals that are experiencing homelessness, or if they don't have insurance, or if they have, if they're in poverty and they have Medicaid, they and they can't get into their primary care physicians, and it's a, you know, a illness that they need to see a doctor, kind of like how we go to a walk-in clinic if we can't go to our general doctor. It's like a walk-in clinic. It's a blessing to have their partnership and to have their services available on our campus, and we enjoy a great working relationship with the staff at St. Bernadette's Clinic, and we value all the work that we're able to accomplish together.
Right, and I'm sure that helps people stay out of hospitals,
yes,
you know, from showing up in the emergency
room.
Yeah. Well, Kim, I got to know you a little bit better. We had met years before, but this past January, Upper Lafayette honored Heroes from the Flood Recovery Effort of 2016, and that is when I got to see more of you in action with Catholic Services on the disaster recovery reliefs. And it seems like this past year has just been one thing after another. August 2016 for Lafayette was just a major event. And if you could talk some about the Acadiana volunteer organization. It's called VOAD, Acadiana VOAD, but if you could talk about your role in Catholic Services and what that group does for our community and how your group has been engaged with that.
So Acadiana Volunteer Organizations Active in Disaster is a coalition of organizations and churches that respond during times of disaster. I think that we really came together in 2005 after Hurricane Katrina and then subsequently Hurricane Rita, and we recognized the need for a collaboration amongst organizations and churches that respond during disaster. We strengthened our relationships at that time, and we've remained a close working group over the years. Anytime that there's been a disaster in our community, rather than working in silos, we understand and recognize that we're better as a community when we work together. When we had the floods in August of 2016, it really had been a number of years since our last major event. All the events in recent years have been very small and isolated, and our response has been, you know, collaborative. But 2016, the flood was a major impact. We're thankful that we had had those established relationships, because when it happened, we were automatically operational. We knew who our partners were. And
who are the partners? Who are some of the people that you partner with?
We work closely with United Way, with Second Harvest, with Food Net, Salvation Army. We're involved, the Presbyterian Disaster Services, the United Methodist Committee on Relief. Our Savior's Church has a nonprofit called Love Acadiana, and they've been a great partner. there's so many partners.
I don't want you to leave out someone.
Yeah, I'm going to leave out a lot of people because there are a lot of people involved in our partnerships.
It's a huge group. Yeah.
And so we, from day one, we understand that each group has their own specialty. Some are champions in the immediate relief and do really well in the immediate aftermath. And so those of us that are more focused on long-term recovery support the efforts of the short-term relief efforts. And United Way does a great job mm-hmm. of the immediate response. Red Cross does a lot of work in the immediate response. And so there's a lot of support that our local community mm-hmm. has towards those organizations. Once the emergency phase dies down, we set up a long-term recovery group. I have served as the chair of the long-term recovery mm-hmm. group since, I think we set it up in September of 2016. And we have been meeting for the first year. We met weekly, every week with about 18 different organizations to come together and to say, how do we respond to this flood collectively and cohesively and collaboratively so that we are working from the same dashboard and that we're not duplicating each mm-hmm. other's services. And we recognize that we had 30,000 homes that were damaged in the flood in our region. And that's a lot of homes. Yeah. We're going to be rebuilding for years. And we recognized that we had very limited resources, even collectively, as much as each one of us had, which wasn't enough. Mm-hmm. When we put all of our resources together on the table, it just wasn't going to be enough. And so we knew the importance that we had to work together. Mm-hmm. And so we worked to create a database so that we were working off of the same list. That was one of the main challenges in the beginning was we all had separate lists of homes that needed to be worked on. So we developed a database to create a streamlined workflow, and we have been working on home after home after mm-hmm. home, and each organization kind of brings their own specialty. One group may have materials that they can bring to the work site. One may have skilled labor. Another group might have funds that they can purchase the things that can't be donated or the labor that can't be mm-hmm. volunteer. And so we have really worked hand in hand over the mm-hmm. last year and some months.
It's been like a family coming together.
It has.
When I've seen it. And I know, Kim, the culmination of this organization was that 8 Days of Hope, mm-hmm. a national group that comes in and kind of swoops in mm-hmm. with 2,000 right. or more volunteers right. came in June into Lafayette because they identified, you can talk more about it, but they chose our community because we were together, and it right. was because of the VOAD, because of Acadiana VOAD's efforts to coordinate, they were able to come into Lafayette where there might have been other communities that needed help mm-hmm. more drastically, but they weren't organized. Right. So can you talk about that effort?
Right. And, so 8 Days of Hope was something that we were very excited about the opportunity to bring to Acadiana. They were a national organization that they deploy these large-scale rebuilding trips, and they were looking for their next community that they were going to work in, and we were one of many communities they were considering for their project, and we had to meet various criteria in order to be considered. Love Acadiana was the major partner for 8 Days of Hope. When they're looking at a community, they look at one organization and they communicate through one organization rather than mm-hmm. communicating through multiple organizations. And so Love Acadiana was the primary partner. And we as a long-term recovery group and were supporting the work of Love Acadiana and securing 8 Days of Hope. We were an easy decision for them because mm-hmm. we were working together as a group, and that is a barrier for many communities across the country, and I'm seeing that now in the work being done in Texas and Florida, that it's challenging to bring all the partners together in one room. A lot of times there's, challenges who gets credit mm-hmm. and there's disagreements, and especially in high stress environments, there's always disagreements and And it's easy to for it to fall apart. And I think that Acadiana has been unique in that we have been willing to work through our challenges, mm-hmm. and that we don't let anyone walk away, even if, you know, if there's some challenges, that we remain committed to each other. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of our spirit in Acadiana.
That's our culture.
And it's part of our culture. And when I go to national conferences and I talk about VOAD relationships, mm-hmm. and working together in disaster, and I hear communities say, it, you know, just can't be done, and it's just too hard to get everybody together, and how do you do it? And I just say, we're just Cajun that way. We're just Cajun that way.
Whether or not we're Cajun by blood. Right. Yeah, that's it's just our community.
The spirit of our community.
It
And we recognize that if we're not working together, that ultimately it's the people that mm-hmm. have been affected by disaster that suffer. It's not us that suffer. It's the people that you know, are living in their homes that have mold in it, people mm-hmm. that are sleeping on their floors because they have no furniture. They're the ones that suffer if we're not working together. And so we have always kept those that are suffering in our community in our focus and in our hearts, and we have put aside our disagreements. And I'll say there's been very few over the last year and a half. And so it really has been a blessing. So 8 days of Hope, we were able to prove that we could house 3,000 volunteers, feed 3,000 volunteers, that we could identify 300 homes that needed work. Mm-hmm. We're able to put materials on site for at least 100 homes for the first day. We're able to get the houses permitted, which is a barrier for a lot of places. We were fortunate to have the mayor's office support mm-hmm. this project, and so he helped us to achieve a lot of the requirements to bring mm-hmm. 8 Days of Hope into Acadiana.
Mayor Joel Robidoux.
That's right. And he was a great partner.
Yeah.
And so
great
we
guy.
Were fortunate to have them select mm-hmm. our community, and I think that one of the greatest outcomes of 8 Days of Hope is that it helped raise the awareness in the broader community that we were still doing disaster recovery almost a year later.
Isn't that amazing? Because you don't really know. If you don't drive right. through certain neighborhoods, there's no evidence
right.
that we had the major flood.
And that's one of the barriers in a flood, is that once the water's gone, mm-hmm. things look normal again.
Unlike a tornado or something.
In a tornado,
where things are in splinters.
Right. You can see the disaster. Mm-hmm. But in a flood, the water goes away. It's hard to see from the street the visible damage inside the home. And so it's hard to keep the attention from the media or from the general public that there's still disaster work going on. And there's still a profound need within Acadiana today.
For last year's flood.
For last year's flood. We have mm-hmm. a lot of work ahead of us, and resources are running out. Funding is very limited at this point, and our ability to fundraise for continued recovery is very difficult because the broader community doesn't understand that mm-hmm. there's still great need. At this point, I feel like we've helped all the easy houses. The houses that remain to be worked on have a lot of work, and they're very expensive projects, and a lot of the homes that were damaged had pre-existing damage in the homes that makes it difficult for us if we're going to go in to do some work in a home related to the flood, if their roof is leaking or if they have mm-hmm. Pre-existing damage in the house, that if we put new materials in, that the other damages in the home would also impact the new work that we do. And so when we're at this point in a recovery, it gets expensive, and there's very, very limited resources available. There's very few organizations that still have money left to do recovery work.
And I guess with all the disasters that we're experiencing this hurricane season, you know, first it was Harvey, and then it's like you turn around and there's who do I give to? There's so many people in need, not just in our community, but nationwide and internationally.
And that's there's been a lot of conversation over the recent weeks about just the compassion fatigue that mm-hmm. we have seen so many images of disaster that it's almost like we've become numb.
Yeah.
And it really is overwhelming when we look at the need that exists in Texas and Florida and Puerto Rico and in the Virgin Islands, that the need is so profound and so deep that it's hard for us to realize that we can make any measurable difference mm-hmm. in any of it. And so I think I would encourage, I spent the last 2 weeks in Texas and saw the profound devastation that they have experienced. And they have knowing what we went through in Acadiana and what we're going through in Acadiana with our recovery and with 30,000 homes that were damaged in a flood, The Beaumont region has about 150,000 homes that were damaged.
And that's not even a large community like Houston.
Right. Well, in encompassing nine counties, it was 150,000 as of right now, the claims. They have a very long road ahead of them.
Yeah.
And, you know, the areas outside of Houston are not getting as much attention. And so the resources are not being directed to the other areas that were affected. They have a very long road ahead of them, and I encourage everyone that I know to find an organization that is committed to the long-term recovery efforts of these communities and make a financial donation. The best way to give in these disasters is financial donations, and they're going to need every dollar that they can get, and because it's going to be a very long road to recovery.
Mm-hmm. Who, if I may ask, what are some of the safe organizations that you recommend that people give to?
So we're, as a Catholic organization, and we operate our disaster response through the Catholic Church is through Catholic Charities. And
of USA.
USA. Oh. And so there are Catholic charities within all the dioceses that that are working in these areas. And Catholic Charities excels in long-term recovery work. And that's really where our strength as an organization nationally is that we remain committed to the full recovery of a community. And oftentimes Catholic Charities within the communities are one of the few that are still at the table years down the road. There are many other organizations. United Ways are always active in their communities after a disaster. Everybody has, if you're affiliated with a church, many of the, like the Methodist or
UMCOR.
UMCOR is very active in disaster. The Presbyterian Church is very active.
So you can stay within your faith and give.
Stay within your faith.
Or look at the major organizations such as United Way or Red Cross, maybe.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So,
well, let's talk about the future of Catholic services. I know that you've recently hired a new employee. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So as we look to, you know, we have evolved over the years to evolve our organization. I hesitate to say that we've grown over the years, but we've evolved over the years. And, you know, to stop doing things that are no longer effective or redundant in the community. And we have started new things that are needed that aren't being addressed. And where we are today is that we're wanting to expand our work to be more regionally focused and to reach outside of Lafayette and to be more regional. And we're wanting to expand the scope of what we're doing to encompass more areas. We now are doing disaster, and there's some other areas of concern to our organization that are not being met in the community that we would like to grow into. And so as we're looking to the future and looking to grow, we've looked at our structure of our organization and have reorganized our leadership. And we created a new position of external affairs and mission integration. And we've hired Ben Broussard for that position, and he'll be starting in November. We're excited about Ben's the talent that he'll be bringing to our organization, and his role will be how we as an organization interface with the community, and how the community interfaces with us as an organization. And we feel strongly that our work doesn't just belong to us, but that our organization is the way in which we fulfill our gospel mandate to feed the hungry and to clothe the naked and to respond to the needs of the poor. And that's not something that can or should be outsourced to an organization, but it's something that all Christians should, you know, be participating in. And so we want the community to be involved in the work that we do, as well as we want to be involved in the needs that exist throughout the region. And so we're excited about the talent that he brings.
He's so well-respected, too.
He's a great guy, and he's very talented. And so we look forward to the contributions that he's going to make in the future of our organization.
Right. Well, congratulations on that great hire.
Thank you.
Yeah. How can people find out more about what you do, Kim? Where would they look online?
So we obviously have a website, and we have an active Facebook page. Each week we post our current needs. Our needs evolve, from week to week. And so that's the easiest way to keep up to date with what, you know, the material needs and the volunteer needs that we have. I know recently we've been focusing a lot on supporting the efforts of our housing programs as we're moving mm-hmm. homeless people into housing. We need help getting furniture.
Yeah, I saw that on Facebook. Catholic Charities. You can just Google that.
Catholic Services of
Services,
Acadiana.
Excuse mm-hmm. me. Catholic Services. I'm ahead of myself there. Catholic Services of Acadiana.
And when we move someone that's homeless into an apartment, it's important to make mm-hmm. that feel like a home. And so we look to furnish these apartments and to help, you know, put the basic household items in the apartment so that it feels like a home. And so we do need help with people to help us move, and we do need help with securing the items to furnish a home. And so I think that's most recently one of our needs. But mm-hmm. our needs evolve every week, and so our Facebook page and our website are the most...
Catholic Services of Acadiana, mm-hmm. yeah. I'd like to thank you, Kim. Did we cover what you
yes.
wanted to? I mean, I'm just so thrilled to have you on the
you.
Podcast. We had talked about this. One of the goals of this podcast, Discover Lafayette, is to shine the light on our wonderful community. And I think we have so many generous people that live here. And when you talked about the Cajun spirit and culture, I think that is what makes our community great. Mm-hmm. People come together and they work together. Mm-hmm. You know, whether or not you have differences or your family and agree 100%, what I see here is that we have a wonderful, supportive community. And Catholic Services of Acadiana is a very big part of that, helping those that need a hand up. So I'd like to thank you, Kimberly
thank you,
James Boudreau, for being on this episode of Discover Lafayette. I'd also like to thank William McFarlane and AOC Community Media for serving as the wonderful support system for Discover Lafayette. You can find Discover Lafayette on iTunes or any media of your choice where you listen to podcasts. And we've just launched our website, discoverlafayette.net. So please check us out and leave some comments on iTunes in particular. If you like the show, please let people know so we can spread the word. Thank you for listening. I'm Jan Swift with Discover Lafayette.
The views and opinions expressed on this or any program on the AOC Podcast Network do not reflect the views and opinions of Lafayette Consolidated Government, Cox Communications, LUS Fiber, AOC Community Media, its Board of Directors, or its staff. To learn more about becoming a community media producer, visit us on the web at aocinc.org.